from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. The pandemic forced many of us to work at home, at least for an extended period of time. What did employees and employers learn that can be applied to new models of how we work? Today we talk with Anne Helen Peterson, author of the new book, Out of Office: The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. Also, writer Grace Cho tells the story of her mother's descent into psychosis and her own quest to understand her family's past. Cho emigrated to the U.S. as a baby with her Korean mother and American merchant marine father. Cho believes the trauma her mother experienced during and after the Korean War contributed to her mental illness. Later, book critic Maureen Carrigan runs down her 10 best list. First News. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Many offices that were shut earlier in the pandemic have reopened or will do so in January, although the new Omicron variant has brought more uncertainty. But for many people, the work-at-home era has already ended or is about to, for better or worse. My guest journalist Anne Helen Peterson says the pandemic created a rare opportunity to rethink the shape of work life. She's thrilled with the new opportunities for change and dismayed by how many organizations are messing it up. Peterson writes about working life. Her new book, written with her partner Charlie Warzel, is called Out of Office: The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. A couple of years ago, Peterson and Warzel gave up office life to become independent journalists and work from home. They also changed the definition of home by moving from Brooklyn to Missoula, Montana, and then to an island off the coast of Washington State. She's learned that working from home and living outside the big city doesn't necessarily prevent burnout. You still need guardrails. Peterson is a former senior writer at BuzzFeed News and now writes her newsletter Culture Study as a full-time venture on Substack. She's also the author of an earlier book called Can't Even: How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation. Anne Helen Peterson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure.
And I want to preface this by saying you mentioned in your book that your book is addressed to that 40 or more percent of people who were able to work at home during the pandemic, many of whom are interested in continuing to do at least some work from home. You want to acknowledge that this is a pretty lucky position to be in, to have been able to work from home, and most people were not in that position. So let's just state that at the jump. But for those who work from home and for businesses who had people work from home, it seems to me there's a big conflict now between the model of let's return to normal work life the way it used to be as soon as possible versus let's see what we learned from the pandemic working at home that we should incorporate into a new normal. Do you see that conflict going on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we've been working from home for nearly 2 years. So a lot of the practices, the habits, the rhythms have become normalized. And we're at the point where I think trying to just jump back into the office 5 days a week is going to feel really weird for people, has already started to feel weird if people have started to go back into the office. And there's a craving for flexibility that I think we're seeing that tension. You know, employees ask for more of that flexibility that they had working from home while also having some of the elements of the office that they really did miss.
So what are some of the most common themes you've heard and read about what people like or liked about working from home?
I think people like not commuting. It's a big one. I think people really like being able to figure out care schedules in a way that works for them. This is specific to parents, but there's all sorts of definitions of care, especially elder care is a big one that people don't talk about as much in terms of schedules. And I also think that people like not having to put on a professional face every day and think about what it means to present yourself for people who pay you, you know, for bosses, for coworkers all the time. And that can mean different things for different people. But I know a lot of people just think about all the time that they've spent not presenting themselves in that way necessarily.
And What are some of the biggest problems people have told you about in terms of working from home?
The hugest one is that work goes everywhere. Work is so slippery. It gets roll over in the morning and you start working, and then there's no real off ramp from work in any capacity. You know, you might stop to pick up your kids or to make dinner, but work is still there in the crevices of your life and you keep working after dinner. I think this was particularly true during the depths of the pandemic when there really was not very much else available for people to do in terms of socializing, but just that feeling that work was all over the place.
Yeah, you write about the importance of guardrails so that you're not working all the time. But that's hard to do, especially if you're working on a very flexible schedule and you're taking time out during the day to be with your children or during the pandemic to help with their education on Zoom or, you know, just at home. So you have to compensate for that by working in the evening. So it gets very blurry throughout the day.
Yeah, and that's the difficult thing, too. I think that sometimes people have this image of what working from home is going to look like that is so rooted in that experience of working from home over the course of the last 2 years, which is not really working from home. You know, I worked from home before the pandemic hit, and it was not what it was like during the pandemic. You know, we were working from home under duress, in confinement, in fear, and oftentimes without childcare. And that is a really different experience than what the future of working home from home can look like. You know, if you have full-time childcare available to you, if you're able to work with other people, you know, go to someone's kitchen table and work with them together, go into co-working spaces, that's really different than what we've experienced over the course of the last few months, few years.
I work from home for over a year during the pandemic, and among the things I really missed about being in the office and in the recording studio is the people who I work with, who I really love seeing. The soundproofing of an office, of a studio, because it's so noisy outside. There's like trucks and lawnmowers and construction. But also that change of scenery. You know, my mother, who went back to work after me and my brother were grown up, she went back to work as a secretary, which was what she was before we were born. And it's not like she loved the work that much, but what she said to me was the best part of the day was leaving home and closing the door. And the other best part of the day was coming home and opening the door. You know, and I thought, like, that's so interesting. And I understand that. That sense of, like, coming and going and changing of scenery is so, it feels important.
Absolutely. And I think that any mother who's had to go through the pandemic, any parent, any caregiver understands that desire to just be away from the spaces in which they are parenting all the time. And that's why I think you also hear from some parents who feel very conflicted about, you know, I am so sick of my kids, but I'm also addicted to my kids and I want to be around them all the time. And understanding that you can feel both of those things at once, like, I don't want to leave the house. I don't want to put on makeup. I don't want to commute, but also I really need to get out of my space. So how do we hold those two ideas in our heads and find something that is a mix of those two things? And for me, you know, there are ways in which I leave the house all the time and get a change of scenery in my working day and the rhythms of my day that don't involve a commute. And I think a lot of people can figure those out as well. But sometimes too, it does mean going to the office. And sometimes I think the way that we've talked about this question, about moving forward with this, there's this dichotomy of it's all remote or it's all office. And what we're advocating for is a real mix of the two.
Yeah, the hybrid model?
Yeah. Or like whatever fits for your industry, for your job, for the type of work that you do. Different types of work have different rhythms. And I think there's no one-size-fits-all solution to this.
Yeah, you're right. You're not anti-office. You're anti-arbitrary office. What do you mean by that?
So the status quo of us being in offices from a certain time to a certain time every day, you know, that standard of 9 to 5 is, I think, how some people think of it. But I think that had expanded significantly so that people were in their offices from 9 to 5, but also working other hours as well. It just, it's very arbitrary. It's based on rhythms that are no longer ours. You know, it's based on an understanding that there is a caretaker at home for most families in the United States, and that's not necessarily the case. You know, kids get out of school at 2 or 3. And so I think it's such a great time to revisit some of these pretty arbitrary understandings of how many hours your butt should be in a chair in the office. You don't need to be in an office to answer emails.
Do you mean that the 9-to-5 model was initially predicated on the wife and mother being home to take care of things, to take care of the children?
Yeah, yeah.
Are there models anyplace in the world where it is a hybrid model and it's been successful? And I mean like before the pandemic, not experimenting after the pandemic, or we're not after yet. It's still during the pandemic.
I always hesitate to bring up a Scandinavian country because people are like, well, of course Scandinavia has it figured
right,
out.
Yeah.
And we'll never be like Scandinavia for any number of reasons. Denmark, you know, a lot of people, when I was writing about this, pointed to some of the ways that there are breaks in their day in Denmark, in which everyone, or a lot of people, men and women, leave the office at an earlier hour that coincides when school and care centers are done. So I think it's like 2 or 3 maybe. And people go home and they feed their families. And then there's oftentimes a little bit of work that is reserved for after that pickup time. So the day is stilted in that way. You know, and I would love to talk and think more about people who are like, well, I hate that because I just have to go back to work, essentially. Like, I want my day to be over. But it also makes it so that you can split the responsibilities for who picks up kids, and you don't have to worry about that awkward aftercare time. You know, a lot of people I know are spending a lot of money to try to figure out what to do with those 2 hours when school is done, but work is not yet done.
What are some of the ways that you think companies are messing up return to office?
One of my favorites, or at least favorites, is no working from home on Fridays. And to me, I understand why companies do this. They think that if you allow people to work from home on Fridays, that they're just going to take a 3-day weekend. And I think that what that does is one, most of all, it shows that you do not trust your employees. You think that they are going to sneak around and fake working and be less productive on a Friday. And maybe, you know, I think sometimes employees figure out ways to do the work that is demanded of them and push off at 3 p.m. on a Friday. And I don't think that there is anything wrong with this. This is where I think like maybe some managers or executives who would be listening to this would be like, how dare she suggest that like there would be 2 hours in the day that an employee is not working and says that they're working or is contracted to work. But you know what I used to do even when I had to be in the office from 3 to 5 on a Friday? I would do nothing, right? My day, my ability to work any longer was over. And this would happen periodically throughout the week too. I was really just wasting time by being in the office. I had, you know, reached my creative limit and I was spinning my wheels. And so what I think companies would be smarter to do is to allow their employees, give their, like, trust their employees in a way that shows that they can figure out when they do their best work. And, you know, for me, I work really poorly on Friday afternoons. It's just not a time for me, but I love working on a Sunday morning. So I exchange times throughout the week in order to do the amount of work that I need to do over the course of that week.
Ann Helen Peterson, thank you so much for talking with us, and I wish you a balanced life, balanced between work and the rest of life, and thank you.
Thank you.
Ann Helen Peterson is the co-author of the new book, Out of Office, The Big Problem and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our book critic, Maureen Carrigan, says 2021 was a great year to get lost in a story. Here's her 10 favorite books of the year.
This was a spectacular year for literary fiction, So my best books list is exclusively composed of novels and short story collections, and I wish I could triple its length, but I'll keep it to 10. Kazuo Ishiguro's Clara and the Sun takes pride of place in this list, as he did in his 2005 novel, Never Let Me Go. Ishiguro here explores what it means to be human through the perspective of a being who's regarded as merely human-like. Ishiguro is the master of slowly deepening our awareness of fragility and the inevitability of death. All that, even as he deepens our awareness of what temporary magic it is to be alive in the first place. Of all our contemporary literary fiction writers, Anthony Doerr is the one whose novels seem to be the most full-hearted response to the primal request, "Tell me a story." Doerr's latest novel, Cloud Cuckoo Land, spans 8 centuries and dramatizes how an ancient tale gives light and hope to 5 young people, each living in dangerous times with correspondences to our own. Francis Spufford's historical novel, Light Perpetual, is a miracle not only of art but of empathy. It opens with a real-life incident, the dropping of a V-2 rocket on a Woolworths in London one Saturday in 1944. What follows is a narrative that unsentimentally imagines the lives that 5 of the victims, all children, might have lived. Light Perpetual is a resonant novel about chance, as well as a God's-eye meditation on mutability and loss. Another historical novel easily vaults onto this year's best books list, Lauren Groff's Matrix. Don't be misled by the title. This is no dystopian thriller, but rather a radiant novel about the 12th century poet and mystic Marie de France, about whose life we know almost nothing. No matter. Groff richly imagines Marie's decades of exile in a royal convent, which she eventually leads. A charged novel about female ambition, Matrix also dramatizes Marie's canny political insight that most souls upon the earth are not at ease unless they find themselves safe in the hands of a force far greater than themselves. I'm beginning to think that any year Colson Whitehead brings out a new novel, I should just reserve a spot on my best books list for it. Harlem Shuffle is a crime story in the sardonic style of Chester Himes' classic Cotton Comes to Harlem, crossed with every film noir ever made about a good man caught up in a bad situation. Ray Carney, a family man, sells used furniture in the New York of the late 1950s and early 60s. You can smell the dust on the blonde wood console radios he's trying to unload as TV sets are taking over. When Ray's cousin lures him into a heist at the Hotel Teresa, the so-called Waldorf of Harlem, Ray's hard-won respectability threatens to crumble. Let's turn to 3 standout short story collections, all debuts. After Parties by the late Anthony Vesna So was one of the big buzz books this year, and it exceeded and upended my expectations. So, who died at the age of 28 before the book came out, was a queer first-generation Cambodian-American who wrote smart, flip, rude, funny, sexually explicit, and compassionate stories about the Cambodian refugee community in Stockton, California. The title novella of Jocelyn Nicole Johnson's collection, My Monticello, is set in the near future when a group of mostly African-American characters takes a last stand against the forces of racism high atop the Little Mountain that gives Thomas Jefferson's plantation its name. That novella is a rich, eerie riff on American mythology. The eight stories in Yoon Choi's collection, Skinship, splinter out to touch on decades of family history shaped, sometimes warped, by immigration. Choi takes that familiar topic and makes her characters' predicaments vivid and nuanced. Two superb novels by seasoned prose round out this 10-best list. In O. William, Elizabeth Strout returns to her writer character, Lucy Barton, who goes on a road trip with her ex-husband that carries them deep into the wilderness of their failed marriage and personal pasts. That summary sounds grim, but if you know Strout, you know that she compresses into the most ordinary conversations, epiphanies about love, parenting, and the untold ways we humans mess up. Finally, I want to give one last plug to a novel that I don't think has yet gotten all the recognition it deserves, Wendela Vida's We Run the Tides. Set in the mid-1980s in the Seacliff neighborhood of San Francisco that's perched on the very edge of the Pacific, the novel follows a squad of four 13-year-old girls also perched on the very edge of things. Haunted, tough, and exquisite, this sliver of a novel summons up a world of female adolescence that I, for one, wanted to remain lost in, and yet also felt relieved to have outgrown.
Maureen Corrigan is a professor of literature at Georgetown University. You can find her 10 Best Books of the Year list at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's Dave Davies has the next interview. Here's Dave.
My guest today, Grace M. Cho, has a compelling new memoir about her relationship with her mother, who emigrated from Korea with her American husband when Cho was a baby. Grace Cho grew up in a small town in rural Washington. Her mother would eventually be diagnosed with schizophrenia. Cho has spent much of her life as a scholar looking into the trauma Korean women of her mother's generation faced, losing family members to the Japanese occupation in World War II and the savage fighting of the Korean War, and struggling to survive in a devastated post-war Korea. As Cho learned more about her mother's life, secrets emerged which were disturbing, but Cho believes her mother's experience may well have contributed to her mental illness. Her mother died in 2008. Grace Cho is Associate Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at the College of Staten Island, City University of New York. She's the author of an earlier book, Haunting the Korean Diaspora, Shame, Secrecy, and the Forgotten War. Her new memoir is titled Tastes Like War. Well, Grace Cho, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were born in South Korea in 1971, right? And as a baby, immigrated with your family to the United States. Tell us where you settled and grew up, what kind of place it was.
Yeah, well, we initially moved to Seattle, but I think we were only there for a few months and then relocated to my father's hometown of Chehalis, Washington. So it's a small town that's about halfway between Seattle and Portland on I-5. The population at the time that we moved there was about 5,000 or a little bit more. And as far as I knew, we were the first immigrants who had arrived for a very long time. And also, as far as I knew, we were the only Koreans to live there during that era of the early to mid-70s.
Right. Your dad was in the Merchant Marine. That's he met your mom when he was stationed in Korea, when he was traveling there.
Right.
You mentioned there were very few Asian Americans, if any, in Chehalis. How were you and your family treated by the locals?
Well, you know, I didn't have that much of a sense of it at first because my early childhood memories were really pretty much enveloped in this world of my mother, that I sort of went with her everywhere and I was a bit sheltered from others. But I do remember sort of having the sense of being isolated a little bit. And then once I started kindergarten, that was when I first had the experience of feeling like an other, because I was introduced to racial slurs like chink and Jap. Children used to tease me and bully me for being Asian. And then I also started to notice that these kinds of things also happened to my mother. sometimes in ways that were even more dramatic than what I had experienced. But I think that, you know, as a mother, she probably wanted to protect me from a lot of that. So she didn't talk about it a whole lot, but there were moments when I witnessed it. You know, for example, there's a scene in my memoir where some teenage boys follow us home, follow us in a car. And then when they get out of the car, there's this confrontation between her and the boys, and they, you know, they make fun of her for being Asian. And so experiences like this sort of accumulated over the time that I grew up in Chehalis, and especially as I got older, when I was a teenager, some of the racial violence sort of merged with sexual violence, in being sort of sexualized for being Asian and things of that nature.
You know, your mother came from a tough life, and we'll talk more of that in a bit. Not somebody with a lot of formal education, but quite a formidable and hardworking person. Just tell us a bit about what she did, the work she did, how she fit into the town.
So the first job that I remember her having was as a maid for this logging tycoon who lived in the next town over. So I have some very vivid memories of that because she used to take me to work with her. And she had a workplace accident where she fell off the ladder. So that's when she had stopped working for him. And then a couple of years later, I think, she began working at a juvenile detention center. She worked the graveyard shift. So it was 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. And I didn't really know a lot about what she was doing there. She said she was a counselor, but that never really made sense to me because it was in the middle of the night. So I didn't understand why anybody would need a counselor in the middle of the night. But she worked that job, I think, from about the time I was 4 or 5 until I was 15, which was when she started to develop some of the symptoms of schizophrenia. But then her other source of income was that she became a forager. And initially she went out into the woods to just look for things to cook and eat, you know, and I think because wild edibles are an important part of Korean cuisine, she was looking for things that she could use in this landscape in which there was not a lot of access to Korean food. But once she went out into the woods, she discovered sort of a gold mine of wild blackberries and wild mushrooms, and she got this idea that she was going to start selling them. And very quickly, our house sort of became this business center for the sale of wild blackberries. And all of these people would come into our house, you know, when I got home after school to buy her wild blackberries. And this was something she did for many years and very successfully. It was quite remarkable.
Your mom's mental illness presented itself in your teen years. How did you become aware of that? What did you see?
You know, it's hard for me to remember exactly the order in which I started to notice things, but there were a few things that sort of happened around the same time. And one was that she stopped foraging very suddenly. And that was something she did with such great passion, and it seemed to be one of her favorite activities. So when she stopped doing that, I guess I didn't think that much about it at the time because I figured she was probably just tired because she worked a lot and she didn't get a lot of sleep. But then I started to notice these other things. And I think what really frightened me was that I noticed that she was sometimes talking to herself in a way that didn't seem typical. Like it sounded like she was arguing with somebody who wasn't in the room. And more things like that started to happen. She exhibited some signs of what Western psychiatry would describe as paranoia, you know, where she thought people were following her. And in fact, things like that had happened. So again, even though my alarm bells were going off, I told myself that this was not something to, you know, to panic about because, you know, people had followed her in the past. There was that incident of the teenage boys following us in the car. But then she started to say things like, well, Ronald Reagan has our phones tapped, you know, that she was going to meet with the governor of Washington State at that time, things like that. So once it started to involve these high-level politicians, I really began to worry.
You were accepted to Brown University after high school and traveled across the country. I mean, from rural Washington, where you live, to Providence, Rhode Island, where Brown is. And you write that as you were introduced to new ideas, you began to think in different ways about your mother's mental illness and what might have affected it. And there was a lot there, because I think it's now accepted that a lot of things can affect the onset of this kinds of serious issues, including environmental factors. You want to just mention what some of those typically are?
So I reference this book called Our Most Troubling Madness that looks at the social risk factors for schizophrenia. And some of those are risk factors that we tend to hear about now, things such as child sexual abuse, poverty, adversity, and social adversity during childhood. But then there were some others that I think are less common, such as being a person of color in a white neighborhood and immigration. And so out of all of the social risk factors that were studied in this book, my mother's case ticked off 5 out of 6 boxes. And I really sort of, thought a lot about the last two that I mentioned, immigration and being a person of color in a white neighborhood, because I think previously I had tried to look to her past in Korea more as the source of her trauma that may have triggered the schizophrenia. But once I had learned about these other risk factors, then it made so much sense that also her experiences in my hometown were also precipitating factors.
Well, let's talk about some of her past in Korea, because it was a hard life. She was born in 1941 when Korea was occupied by the Japanese army. What do you know of what she and her family might have experienced then?
So what I do know is that she was born in Osaka in 1941. I don't know the conditions under which her mother or the rest of my family, I'm not exactly sure who was in Osaka at that time. I'm not really sure.
That's in Japan, right?
That's in Japan,
Even though she was Korean, yeah.
Right. So I'm not sure the exact conditions under which they were taken to Japan. But I do know from my research that the province where my mother's family is from, Gyeongsang province, is the closest to Japan. And so because of the proximity, they took a lot of the laborers from there, and more specifically, they took a lot of young women and girls to work as quote-unquote comfort women, doing forced sexual labor for the Japanese imperial troops. And so, my best guess is that my mother's parents, or maybe just her mother, were forced laborers for the Japanese. And I'm not, it's not clear to me whether or not my grandmother was a sexual laborer or not, but the history suggests that there's a good chance that that was true.
So after World War II ended, Korea was divided at the 38th parallel, the communist regime to the north, the U.S.-backed anti-communist government in the south. And then 5 years later, the Korean War erupts and lasts for nearly 3 years. And, few Americans know much about the Korean War. Give us a sense of the consequences of the savage fighting and therefore the civilian population of Korea.
The civilian death toll was really staggering during the Korean War, where 3 million civilians were killed. I mean, there are varying estimates of that number, but that's one of the less conservative numbers. There were another 2 million that were categorized as missing or wounded. And then if you factor in all of the families that were separated, because at the end of the fighting, not the end of the war, because the war technically never ended, but at the end of fighting in 1953, when the armistice agreement was signed, the border between North and South was permanently sealed, so that 10 million families were separated. So that is a staggering number when you consider that the entire population of the peninsula was 30 million.
And what about your mom's family? What was the toll it took on them?
When I was in fourth grade and I was doing a family tree, that's when I found out that she had had 2 other siblings, because I only knew her, her sister in Korea. But she said that she had 2 other siblings that either died or disappeared. and her father also died. And, you know, interestingly, the deaths were not directly as a result of the war, but, you know, related to the devastation caused by the war.
When you spoke to your mom about that, was it painful? How did she describe the impact of it?
She didn't exactly describe anything. She told me what happened to them, and then she took a deep sigh, and she said, "Aigu tapdabara," which is an expression in Korean that means, I mean, literally it means something like, you know, I'm suffocating, or I'm stifling. That refers to the sadness being so heavy that you just can't speak.
After the Korean War ended, I mean, the economy was pretty devastated. And you write that, you know, young Korean women could either work in a factory or they could go to one of the U.S. military bases. There was a heavy U.S. military presence there where there were various kinds of employment. Your family moved to Busan. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Which is
yes,
yeah, which is where there was a military base. What do you know about what they did there? What your mom did?
Well, you know, growing up, she never told me what she did in Korea. I often asked her, but she either would not answer me. She would just sort of stare at the wall and act as if I wasn't speaking to her. There was one occasion when she dissuaded me from taking a job waiting tables, because she said that you know service work is something that's very difficult, and you know that she really didn't want me to do it. And I asked her, I said, "Were you a waitress in Korea?" And she just said something like that. So I knew that she worked in the service industry. I didn't know exactly what it was. And then there was a moment when my sister-in-law revealed to me that my mother had been a sex worker at the U.S. Naval Base in Korea. And, you know, it was quite a devastating moment for me to learn that. And I spent then the rest of my adult life trying to process it in various ways, one of which was through research and writing. And so it sort of set me on this path to do the work that I do today.
So you heard this from your sister-in-law, that your mother had been a sex worker. She, I think, later in the book says, well, she may have just been a cocktail waitress. But what did you hear from, you talked to your father about this at one point. What did he say?
Yeah, so interestingly, I had conversations with my father and my brother about it. But there, you know, the word prostitute or the word sex work, you know, those were such taboo words that no one repeated them. So we sort of talked about it without actually talking about it, if you know what I mean. But when I first confronted my father about it, he said, well, he was almost in tears. And he said, I didn't have anything to do with her being there. I got her out of there. And my response was, but of course you had something to do with her being there because of supply and demand. And so I think he was very shocked by my response, by the question, and also my response.
And what you meant by that was that your father was a client of her. That's how their relationship began.
Yes, that's what I meant. And, you know, he did not deny it. He just said that he had saved her from that situation, which he may, in fact, have done, because there are plenty of stories of sex workers in Korea who marry their clients, because the clients pay off their debt and allow them to leave.
So, you know, when you look at your mother's experience, I mean, losing family members to war, I mean, experiencing the war in itself must have been horribly traumatic. And then, you know, becoming a sex worker for who knows how long, and then enduring the condemnation of other Koreans for having, you know, consorting with the Americans. I don't know. How do you assess that in terms of its effect on her mental health?
Well, I mean, I have more questions about it than I do answers, because there's so much that I don't know, and I also don't want to make too many assumptions, because I don't know that being a sex worker in itself is psychologically damaging. But I do know that she did that work under, under oppressive conditions, right? So the she didn't really have a lot of say in her work conditions. Or, rather, I should say that women who worked in these settings didn't have a lot of agency in terms of their work conditions, right? So they may have made a choice to enter the sex industry, but they didn't agree to the abuse and violence that they encountered once they were there. So that has got to have a toll on someone's psyche. And I think that according to what my father had told me when we had that conversation, he said she hated doing it and she did it as seldom as possible. So that also tells me that it was extremely difficult for her to even, you know, make that leap into the sex industry. And of course, you know, her experiences with the war, the fact that she said so little about it over the years, I think is an indication of the trauma. I mean, she did tell me one story about having been a refugee separated from her family at the age of 9. And after doing my research for my first book, which really focused on civilian experiences, I just thought she must have witnessed so many horrific things because I saw it there in the archives and I saw it in the stories of the other survivors that they, you know, they routinely saw dead bodies and really, you know, grisly, gruesome things as they were on the run searching for safety.
Did she go hungry at times? Did she ever talk about that?
You know, she alluded to it. She never put it so plainly as that, but during the time that she was separated from her family, she lived off of a jar of kimchi and some rice, and she made it last for, you know, I think it was about 9 months until she was able to find her family again. And she also talked about how they would hunt small animals in the woods, things like spiders and little birds.
You want to explain the title of the book, Tastes Like War?
Yeah, so that's a quote from my mom. At one point, when she was living in the apartment that was above my brother's garage, I went to visit her, and I asked her if she was getting enough to eat, and she said yes. And then she mentioned that there was some powdered milk there, but she wasn't eating it. And I asked her why, and she said, I can't stand the taste of it. It tastes like war. And so it really stayed with me that she had said that, because at the time I was also researching the experiences of Korean civilians who received American food aid. And there was one testimony that stood out about a woman who said that her whole village was just drooling at the thought of the American food aid, and they were hoping for rice or barley, but when they opened up the barrels, it was powdered milk. And that they all used the powdered milk and drank it regardless of whether or not that was what they wanted to eat. But because so many Koreans are lactose intolerant, they all suffered for days with diarrhea from it. And so I thought that that expression, tastes like war, sort of was a perfect encapsulation of how some of her food experiences spoke to this history of having survived the war.
You know, your brother, as you know, wrote something online, I guess in late October about the book, disputing many parts of it, saying that it should be regarded as fiction. But one of the things he said was that he felt that you made no effort to interview living members of the family to see if their memories were consistent with your own. What about that? How much did you talk to people in the family who, you know, I mean, I have three sisters, and whenever we talk about events in our lives, and sometimes significant ones, we remember things differently. Memory's a funny thing that way. I mean, what did you do to check your own memories of all this?
First of all, I want to say that I think it is a good idea to interview family members for your memoir if you have the kind of relationship with those family members that would allow for that kind of dialogue. In this case, I do not. I think that my family members have been trying to keep the family secrets so that if they have, you know, they have a sister who wants to be public about it, if I go to them saying, do your memories match mine, they're just going to try to shut down the writing completely.
Can you understand your brother and your sister-in-law's impulse to want to keep your mother's history private?
Well, I do understand their impulse, and I know that they You know, they didn't want her history to be public. But, you know, when I learned that information about my mom, it profoundly shaped the rest of my life. I mean, it was really one of the largest forces in my life to try to understand the social context, the political context of my mother's life, but also to denounce the shame and stigma that is attached to sex work. And so, I mean, I understand that they don't want it to be public, but it's also my story. It's my mother as well. And, you know, I have only the best intentions of it, which is that I want my mom to be seen, and I don't want her to have to hide behind some whitewashed version of who she was, because it's not a salacious tell-all memoir. It is really just something that's motivated by my love for my mother and my desire to honor her, by trying to understand her history and to really denounce the shame and the stigma that damaged her psyche, and to, you know, to do the same for other people who, you know, might be attached to some label like schizophrenic or sex worker, to let them know that we can see them in their humanity, and that, that, you know, those labels do not have to define them.
Families are complicated, and a crisis like this kind of illness certainly doesn't make things easier. Grace Cho, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
Grace M. Cho is an associate professor of sociology and anthropology at the College of Staten Island, City University of New York. Her new memoir is called Tastes Like War. She spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.